Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, and hope that everybody is enjoying the Memorial Day weekend. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now to discuss the week on world markets as the United States commemorates Memorial Day are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Ablafia of the Teal Group Consultancy. Guys, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Thanks, Vago. Good to be here.
Great to be here, Vago.
Pleasure as always. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. Elbit Systems of America is sponsoring our virtual coverage of the Quad A and SOFIC trade shows. And Bell, of course, sponsors this podcast. Ron, start us off. There's an emerging market consensus that maybe the markets have been a little bit too buoyant, that some of the economic news that's down the pike is actually pretty negative. And then there's the increasingly tense relationship between Beijing and frankly, the rest of the world, that China is increasingly bullying governments, making it clear that if you criticize Beijing, Beijing is going to cut off trade with you. Australia called for an investigation of the coronavirus and the initial outbreak. China cut off Australian beef. It's delivered that same message to European countries at the end of the day. So not only are we seeing some market buoyancy, but at the same time, a decoupling between China and the West as we have an overall deglobalization going on, right? I mean, this is pretty much as storm cloudy as it gets, and the markets kind of are bouncing along pretty positively. I just want to get quickly, you know, everybody's take on all of these trends and how you see them developing, because every week there's just a little bit more evidence to suggest that where we're going is very problematic.
Broadly, if you look at the S&P as a measure of the markets, at least the U.S. markets, last 5 days, it's up 1.5%. Last month, it's up just a smidge under 7%. In the last 3 months, it's up almost 35%. And if you compare that to how most of the commercial aerospace stocks have done, they haven't done quite as well. So what we're seeing is, we don't want to call it the opening up trade or the reopening trade. And I think that's what, you know, the market was discounting in, you know, over the last couple of weeks. And I think the commentary that you're referencing about, you know, market pundits questioning, you know, why is the market where it is, so on and so forth, because the economic fundamentals obviously aren't going to match up with where the market is. But the market's trying to look through it all back to a time that's more, quote unquote, normalized. I hate the phrase normalized, but investors seem to like it. And to back to a phrase where, you know, back to a time where things are more normalized. Let's call it, you know, before Corona, BC. So if we get back to kind of a framework that's BC. Commercial aerospace, obviously being in the eye of the storm, has lagged that. We've had more incoming calls from investors lately asking, you know, if you were going to get involved with aerospace, where would you go? That kind of thing. So I think people are just trying to think about, you know, if we were to trade a reversion to the mean in aerospace relative to the rest of the market, where would you go? And you know, I guess the risk there is, as you pointed out, I mean, the economic fundamentals aren't great. And it's anybody's guess to some extent, you know, where we go to from here. On the Beijing front, I don't think the market's fully contemplated, not even, you know, fully contemplated, not even partially contemplated, what the escalating situation with Beijing and much of the rest of the world means, not alone just for, you know, commercial aerospace, but, you know, commercial aerospace defense and just the broader markets. Like we highlighted last week, you know, it was, for myself anyway, you know, just a hugely important event that Taiwan Semi said that they would build a 5-nanometer microprocessor facility. I should say a facility that makes 5-nanometer microprocessors, not a 5-nanometer professor facility, really small facility anyway, but you know what I mean, right?
It's a very small facility, but the Taiwanese really can pull it off. Very small plant. Big outputs.
That they're going to do that in Arizona. And it's just, and then, you know, you saw later in the week, you highlighted, there was a document drop that highlighted what, you know, the administration is thinking. So I don't think the market's really, really contemplating this at all. And if you think about it from a defense perspective, it's got implications for, you know, the defense contractors that, you know, underwrite and support, you know, long range, you know, projection of power. It's got implications across a whole bunch of industries. And I don't think the market's really started to digest it yet. I mean, I was actually honestly just astonished on Friday when everything started to change pretty dramatically in Hong Kong that the market didn't react more meaningfully to that. And that's probably because, you know, we're going into a long holiday weekend, volumes are very light. But I wouldn't be surprised if we, when we get back this week, that the market's going to, you know, sit back and start to try to, you know, account for all this.
Well, I mean, think about it, right? China accounts for 20 to 25% of Boeing's backlog and is, you know, critical to the 787 program as well.
Oh, for sure. I mean, when you look at Boeing's production outlook, right? So they said, you know, they're going to go from what, like, they're not delivering anything, going from zero to 10, back to seven. So on average, kind of like seven. Well, part of that, a chunk of that is China, right? And, you know, they've, you know, told that to the investment community. That's no secret, right? So if the Chinese don't take their 787s, there has to be a haircut to those 787s for sure. And then when you look at the 737 MAX backlog, you know, the Chinese are probably on the order of maybe 20-25% of that backlog, maybe a little bit more. So if the Chinese, you know, push out taking their 737s and their 787s, that for sure has a material impact on Boeing.
Sash, let's get your take, and Richard, yours as well, on all of these themes, even though, Sash, I think I know exactly what you're going to say.
I would be very cautious about looking at day-to-day or even week-to-week movements in the stock market at the moment, and particularly as it applies to the aerospace and defense sectors, and seeing those as somehow telling us something about the underlying fundamentals. It's important to realize that volumes are remarkably light, and that we're getting pretty dramatic swings in share prices. You know, a 5% swing in share prices is not unusual, particularly in Europe at the moment, daily, purely on the basis of people becoming slightly more optimistic about the lockdown being lifted, or slightly less optimistic about the lockdown being lifted. And I think it's very important to see through those, you know, shifts in sentiment. Fundamentally, the underlying issues for the civil aerospace industry have only got worse in the last couple of weeks. And just because, you know, you may have seen a couple of aeroplanes in the sky today, which is, you know, it's red letter stuff now, that doesn't make the civil aerospace market somehow incredibly attractive again. We have had this massive loss of value in across the entire civil aerospace sector, from airlines through to suppliers, and it's not going to come back. You know, it's going to take years to get back to the level we were at the end of 2019. And 2021 production is going to be dramatically lower than it is at present, in our view.
Richard?
You look at the historical role of China in climbing out of past downturns, both on the air travel demand front and on the jetliner order and intake front, just played a huge role. You know, I mean, I remember saying this, you know, as far back as the 90s, you know, just in the mid 90s downturn, people started mentioning China to me, and I had only thought of it as a place I'd gone backpacking in my youth, and all of a sudden it really came on the radar, and it started growing in double digits, and no matter what happened, it was double digit growth. And oh boy, you know, it got to that, 20 to 25% that we cited. And here the absolute best case scenario is they stay as is and grow at a much slower pace. You know, by the end of 2018, growth was starting to downshift, and 2019 was basically half the growth we saw in 18. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario, of course, is the end of, you know, what Mal Ferguson called Chimerica. You know, that is terrifying, the idea that all of a sudden that would be gone. And yet, the way things look right now, with so many warning signs, that would appear to be the baseline scenario.
Rolls-Royce cut 9,000 jobs in Derby. Safran is cutting deep as well. Sash, why don't you start it off, given how closely you look at Rolls. and what this means for the supply chain, right? Why are these companies moving as aggressively as they are before Boeing and Airbus have actually even announced the kind of cuts that I think all of us expect, but neither have elucidated?
Short answer is because they don't believe the official figures from Boeing and Airbus at the moment, and they have got to act now. They can't afford to wait for Boeing and Airbus, which is a pretty depressing reflection of the loss of, you know, the lack of leadership coming from Boeing and Airbus at the moment. Rolls-Royce, yes, you're absolutely right, this week, 9,000 jobs, of which probably about two-thirds will be in Derby, which is the head of the center of the civil aerospace business there. The remainder will be scattered around the globe, probably in, you know, Germany, Singapore, and even the US. And Rolls very, very clear that the market is not coming back within any foreseeable time horizon, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And given that the market is not going to come back to the level that it was at, you know, as I said earlier, end 2019, they have got to cut and they can't afford to wait. And I think it's very interesting that the aero engine companies are being much more realistic and are taking a lead in this, and Boeing and Airbus aren't. Airbus is going to, you know, said that they will talk about production and presumably by that stage, employment levels sometime around the end of June. Interestingly, when they said that with their first quarter results about a month ago now, they said, we don't expect to adjust the production very much. I would be very surprised if they are still able to say that. I think they're going to have to, you know, talk about quite significant cuts from here, and the employment cuts are going to have to be at least that much, because Airbus has got the issue, as does Boeing, that it has multiple production lines in multiple, in Airbus's case, countries, and in Boeing's case, states. That was great when this was an industry that was producing the thick end of 2,000 aircraft a year and delivering those. But if we're down sub 1,000, those may be luxuries that we just can't afford anymore.
I'm sorry for misspeaking, but even 6,000 job cuts in an East Midlands town of, what is it, about 250,000 or so?
Yeah, it's huge.
It's really a massive, massive impact.
Yes, and you know, it's a very, very big employer there. And you know, this is something which clearly concerns the UK government as well. But there's nothing that you can do as a government when there's no market there. It's not as if this is the company failing. This is the market has stopped and stepped down.
Richard and Sash, what are your guys' expectations of how many more are going to follow along these lines? Because these are very, very high skill, very high value, very highly coveted jobs, and are the sort of thing that deepens any recession.
Well, I would just point out that Rolls-Royce, in a lot of ways, is a bit of a worst-case scenario, not necessarily because of bad strategy, although there certainly has been some of that in recent years. But the main problem is that they stake their horse to the exact type of jet that no one really wants right now, which, of course, is a twin aisle, and specifically Airbus twin aisles. And not only that, but they kind of went sole source. That, you know, that their objective was to be for Airbus what GE was for Boeing twin aisle jets, except that, of course, GE also has CFM. So yeah, everyone right now, when possible, is trying to replace, say, an A330 with an A321neo, which is terribly good for people who make single aisle engines, which Rolls-Royce does not. And meantime, you know, so much of Rolls-Royce's strategy was predicated upon aftermarket revenue, which of course is simply not happening, because not only are people avoiding taking new twin aisles, they're also parking what they've got. So this is an extreme worst case scenario. And I've been speculating for some time that I'm not sure Rolls can go it alone forever. I mean, obviously you've got the complicating factor of transatlantic politics, but this would seem to be a company that might just fit well with somebody else. You know, for years we've been discussing whether or not, decades really, you know, a Pratt & Whitney Rolls connection would make sense. That's complicated by the emergence of Raytheon Technologies. But, you know, it's tough to see how they get through this without either a lot more government intervention or some kind of restructuring.
That's a heartbreaking prospect for those of us who are giant fans of the company and its extraordinary heritage of aviation innovation. But
absolutely,
I mean, if I can just cut in, I think the government intervention is a given. You know, governments at the moment, and the UK government in particular, will do what it takes to protect an iconic national high technology manufacturer. If it's as simple as that, then actually Rolls is going to get through this. And our view is they probably will get through this for that reason, and for the fact that their cash flow is probably just about up to it. But the broader issue, which is that Rolls-Royce's product range is very, very narrow, and it's heavily skewed towards wide bodies that nobody wants. That's going to make the next 3-4 years very, very tough. I totally agree with Richard there.
Ron?
Yeah, I guess one point I would add, just kind of building on both Richard and Sasha's remarks, when you think about the engine suppliers, they have to be on the leading edge of making adjustments to rate and employment and cost structure, largely because they're the lead times for their products. And then B, they make a lot of their money in the aftermarket. And what you're not going to see is not just aftermarket not happening because of lack of demand, because of flights not happening, but also one of the more profitable things they do is they provision for new aircraft going into fleets. So when you think about CFM, presumably there would have been a lot of provisioning for the LEAP engines for the new MAXes going in. And all that got pulled back. When you think about Rolls exposure on the wide body aircraft, all that provisioning is just not going to happen. So given where they are in the supply chain and the lead times for a lot of the things they do, those complex castings and the forgings and ring rolling and all that sort of stuff, that stuff's 9 months, 12 months, 18 months out. So they really have to make decisions now about where they think rates are going to go, because they just don't have the luxury of making that decision later because of the lead times.
At what point is there, we saw an impact on the F-35 that Lockheed Martin confirmed. We talked about this on the fact that the F-35 program would be affected in part because of how dramatically Leonardo was affected. And obviously that company is a very, very important F-35 partner. Let's talk a little bit more broadly, that the military aerospace industry and the commercial aerospace industry, especially from a supplier base standpoint, are very, very conjoined. And the Pentagon has been ringing alarm bells, and we even heard that from Navy Acquisition Chief Hondo Gertz last week when he spoke to reporters, that he said he's not particularly concerned about the shipbuilding industry, which will be able to deliver with maybe some schedule impact, but he was much more concerned about what happens on the aviation side of the house. How concerned are you guys about a knock-on effect from commercial into direct and it having a much more meaningful impact on programs, whether it's the the B-21 program, F-35 program, even F-15, as well as F-16 and other lines?
Of course, it's a big concern. Generally speaking, what you hear is, it's a concern when you look at the smaller suppliers, the quote unquote mom and pop suppliers who don't have the balance sheets and the financial wherewithal to get through this, that they'll need some sort of support. Will they get that? Won't they get that? So if you're a small supplier and call it 80% of your business is commercial, 20% is defense, that's a really hard equation. But when you go up the food chain, we even worry about some of the bigger suppliers. Given the unprecedented magnitude of this, if you're a supplier and you're really outweighed, when it was really, really rich in commercial in terms of your revenue mix, it's really tough sledding right now. One name that comes to mind is Spirit Aerosystems, right? I mean, Spirit is we used to say, we still say, more Boeing than Boeing, right? Because they're limited defense exposure. But that gives them, a particular vulnerability today because they have so much commercial. And it's not that they don't, they're on some fine defense programs, so on and so forth. But, the impact that this will have on them and is having on them is meaningful. The management team's working hard to get through it. And you can go through various scenarios and you can go through scenarios that say, yeah, they'll get through this. But then you can also go through scenarios and say, you know, they won't. So it's not just limited to, you know, the smallest of suppliers. When you go up that food chain, it gets pretty, can get pretty difficult for everybody involved. It is encouraging, however, that it does appear that, you know, the Department of Defense does recognize that. However, it's unclear on how much they can do about it, given, you know, what they buy, who they buy it from, and what, you know, and the volumes they buy. So we'll see.
I would certainly agree with all of that. You know, what are the possible remedies? You know, for one, it's just flat out restructuring. You know, you don't want to restructure an industry at the point of a gun, but sometimes it just has to happen. And I've heard the number posited that maybe 20% of the supply chain has to, you know, go away, that basically just merge with other folks. And another possibility, of course, is, you know, selective vertical integration by not just primes, but also first tiers. Basically, you know, and Honeywell and Raytheon have alluded to this, you know, they'll be looking around out there for opportunities, and maybe those opportunities need to be coordinated with the primes or DOD or whoever else. But, you know, looking upstream for acquisitions is certainly, you know, it fits in with the recent renewed interest in vertical integration, I guess you could say. And then, you know, finally, there's the national security aspect that Ron just mentioned with Ellen Gordon and others looking at it and making sure that, you know, you don't see more companies basically just purchased by China. That had been a sort of a feature of the landscape in the 2000s. And you had some, you know, pretty impressive companies like FACC in Austria, or, you know, obviously Continental Motors, you know, folks like that purchased by China. And I think that's an outcome they would like to avoid given the current geopolitical climate.
Well, I mean, I think it's also pretty clear that this administration, and it doesn't matter what an administration comes in, would be turning it down, just like I think European nations would be turning it down as well. And to Ron's earlier point, we talked to Duane Hawkins last year of Spirit AeroSystems, and the massive drive the company was making to try to expand its defense footprint and sort of move up the value chain on the defense side of things, just as it was on commercial as well. Sash, I want to bring you in because I know you've got something you want to add as well.
There's clearly an awareness by European governments that they've got to be careful about the transfer of technology to China. But I wouldn't be so certain that if a, to our point, you know, to our mind, significant, but ultimately tier two, tier three supplier, you know, became very, very distressed, I wouldn't be so sure that European governments would be able to protect it quickly enough to stop Chinese interests from buying it, frankly. And that's what happened to FACC in Austria. I think it's going to be quite a burden on the OEMs, on the primes. I think the primes are going to be the first port of call when major suppliers become distressed. I don't talk to many primes in Europe who look forward to becoming more vertically integrated. In fact, I don't talk to any that do, but there is an acceptance, certainly that I can detect, that this may happen for part of the next cycle, simply because they've got to keep their supplier base, you know, at least, you know, up and walking, if not up and running, and that's going to cost them money. I think they're going to be the first port of call when tier twos, tier threes become distressed.
And so the bottom line is gird for greater costs and bankruptcies and hope that either mergers solve it, because the government aid is likely not going to be enough to really bail them out at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. Let's go to the question of retiring airplanes. On this program, if you were listening, Richard Abulafia very early on said, if it's got four engines, it's likely a death knell. And we had Delta, albeit, you know, and airlines have been announcing the retirement of older as well as large airplanes. Delta last week retiring, saying that it's going to retire its 777s. And this week, Air France KLM followed by saying that it's going to sunset nine. Oh, well, I guess it owns five, right? And it leases nine. So four more. So it's a total fleet of nine A380s. I believe the word that you would rather I use than retire is slaughter, Sash, the A380s. Who wants to pick this up about what this means and what else are we going to see? And at the end of this, are all the A380s grounded? And what does that mean for Airbus as it continues to build? Because last week, or maybe earlier, I asked whether or not it might make better sense for the company to just stop producing the A380 a lot earlier than its planned stop production date of next year.
That I don't think anybody's going to pick those A380s up. And I think that once A380s are grounded, I think they'll stay there until they're cut up, and they'll be cut up pretty quickly. There's no point in leaving them sitting on the tarmac when there is clearly no secondhand market for A380s. These things cost $30 million or more to refurbish. Four large engines, the overhaul costs on those are huge. We are seeing the death of the quad, the A380, the A340, the 747. There are going to be very, very few of these flying in passenger service by the end of next year. It's terribly sad, but once they're grounded, they stay grounded in our view.
The audience, we normally have a very robust and remarkably funny conversation before these started. And the slaughter response was in response to me saying pasturing those airplanes. And Sash disabused me of the notion that they're going to go to some pleasant pasture somewhere and frolic around until they're rescued by some other loving family at the end of the day. Richard?
Yeah, there's okay, maybe there is something vaguely bovine about an A380, but the idea that they're going to be put out to go munch
on the A3, is it the A3 turkey? We've discussed turkey. This, gobbling its way across the sky.
It's just always a ridiculous plane. And I always thought that, well, if nothing else, fine, it'll carry on some sort of zombie-like existence with Emirates. But last week or so, even Emirates with 115, I believe, of 230-something orders. And even they're saying, oh, yeah, oh, dear, we might need to just dump them forever, which is incredible because they stake their brand, their identity, their strategy, everything on the A3 Turkey. Just truly bizarre. So there's a special place in industry economic hell for this plane. $25 billion to develop, tens of billions more to build because it never got to break even. And then lots of people holding the notes, the legendary Dr. Peters group of random German pension, or dentists and lawyers, pension funds and whatever else. I mean, there is so much carnage that gets you way past $50 billion in economic damage for a plane that it turned out no one really wanted at all.
And that is extraordinary. And Tom Enders wanted to shoot earlier, and it was pressure that he got from everybody to just continue manufacturing a little bit longer in order to be able to satisfy the Emirates orders and the hope that Singapore was going to come in for some more as well.
Yeah, and of course, the DNBN foo moment of the whole thing must have been the Rolls-Royce inspired A380 Neo. Let's throw in another parachute battalion to this besieged fortress. I mean, just truly a bizarre idea. And while I have enormous respect for Rolls-Royce, and as we were saying before, just the image of this company that was placing all of its bets on bespoke engines for Airbus wide bodies, no matter how ridiculous, like the 380 Neo, that's going to get you into trouble, serious trouble.
I'm sorry. I'm never going to be able to look at the A380 without thinking of DMBM Fu again. Ron?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a heck of a lot to add to Richard and Sasha's comments. I mean, it's clearly a quad-powered airplane is an anachronism in today's world and in the current environment for sure. I just caution folks to not throw every older wide-body out. And meaning, what I mean by that is, if you look back to what happened after 2001, we went through a period where the 757 was a very, very unpopular airplane. Eventually, Boeing shut down the line. But ultimately, it made a really strong comeback, right?
And right.
If you caught some Boeing people in their quieter moments, they might have admitted that maybe we shut that one down too early. And another airplane that comes to mind is the 767-300ER. There's a lot of talk that all the 67s will get retired and so on and so forth. But You know, the 767-300ER could be another example of the 757 where it's a capable airplane. You know, the you'll be able to pick up some of those airplanes at some pretty startling values, would be my guess, if you were trading used airplanes in the current market. And some of them aren't that old. I mean, the airplane really kind of, what, the last one was produced in 2014. So, you know, there's some, you know, later model 767-300ERs that could make a nice comeback. So just, you know, caution folks to not kind of throw all the older wide bodies or, you know, in one kind of camp, and that kind of thing. But for sure, you know, the A380, as we all know, I mean, it's a big Achilles heel. It's just not very flexible. Where, you know, a 767-300ER, you can do a lot of different things with it. It's a pretty flexible airplane. And that's why something like that, I think, has a chance of coming back.
It's an extraordinary airplane. It's a very, very comfortable airplane. But again, right, I mean, all of this is driven by economics. Okay, we've got a very limited amount of time. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the UK adopting a 14-day self-isolation policy for travelers. Britain has now adopted that. But a number of European nations have done that as well, Norway being one of them. Sash, why don't you lead us off about what on earth this means going forward, and how do you even do this?
I don't think the UK government even knows how they're going to do it. I mean, at the moment, it's, you know, the suggestion is that you'll be required to give the address of the place that you will be isolating at when you arrive at the airport, and that there may be spot checks thereafter. But even the police are saying, well, we're not going to do spot checks because we've got criminal scout and catch. So it's not a terribly workable suggestion, but I'm sure that there will be an attempt to enforce it early on. And it makes a recovery of air travel, and particularly business air travel in the UK, certainly over the summer, very, very hard to consider indeed. And I think this is going to, you know, a number of airlines are starting to put on some quite serious capacity from the 1st of July. Some of them are even offering to route through Dublin because, of course, there is a common trade area between the UK and a common travel area between the UK and the Republic of Ireland. That dodge may work for a while, but I think that if the UK government does want to impose this, it's going to knock the airline industry back another couple of quarters before there's any sort of meaningful recovery. And, you know, the more this is enforced across other countries of Europe, the harder it is for any recovery to take place.
Richard and Ron, want to add to that before I have one quick Dominic coming question, because Sash mentioned the word police, and so it came to mind, and then a Russian air defense question.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, there's a wonderful piece in the Times today, New York Times, for international listeners, basically talking about, you know, hey, this is, we're going to have a new generation that takes vacations at home. That is to say, you know, domestic travel rather than the wonderful boom times of international travel that this last generation, including ours, really enjoyed. And it resonated with me. As a matter of fact, as you know, Vago, the Abu Alfia clan was heading to Norway this summer, and now we're heading to Maine instead for obvious reasons. And this might just go on for some time. And as we said, that's going to suppress the recovery even further.
Ron?
That really takes a bite out of business travel, right? I mean, you just can't, right. That's totally untenable with business travel. So, yeah, I mean, leisure travel too, but you mix the, you know, fly to London, have lunch, fly back concept out the window.
That's what's really going to be the most profound, because those are the seats where the airlines actually make money as opposed to the seats in the back of the airplane, right?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Sash, speaking of police, police are talking to Dominic Cumming, the special advisor to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. I believe he broke the UK isolation rules by traveling to Durham, which is about 260 or so miles outside London, ostensibly to see his parents at a time when he was supposed to be self-isolating because he and his wife were sick or whatever it is, and now enormous calls for Cumming, obviously one of the architects of Brexit, to resign. So far, Boris Johnson is sticking by him, but a number of other senior government officials have had to resign because they have broken these quarantine rules. What happens if Dominic Cumming is forced to resign?
I think it'd be a loss because he's really the policymaker in chief for Boris Johnson's government, and he's the guy with the, you know, with the vision. He's very iconoclastic. his loss, I think, would really sort of put a hole in any post-coronavirus policymaking in the Johnson government. As far as defense is concerned in particular, he's very much been a driver of some of the more radical ideas in the UK Strategic Defense Review. Now, that review is currently on ice because of the coronavirus, but I think he was looking and pushing for much more radical ideas within the Strategic Defense Review than the Minister of Defense and the service chiefs would have done on their own. So he would be really missed, I think, as a radical were he to go. But you've got to remember, he's a policy guy. He's not a front-facing politician. The police have talked to him. There's every chance he's, that's the end of it. But he's a guy who's got a huge number of enemies, hence the noise that we're getting about this at the moment.
Yeah, and I think some people would be extremely satisfied to see him go the way of the dodo. Russian-supplied air defense, still not as good of a reference, obviously, as the MBM-FU, and clearly my pasture reference was brutally shot down earlier. And speaking about being shot down, Russian-supplied air defense systems, Sash, you said, are an epic fail versus Turkish-operated unmanned aerial vehicles in Libya. Talk to us about what trend or thing interesting you see there.
Yeah, I mean, this is as far away from civil aerospace as we can possibly get. But there's a proxy war going on in Libya. There's a government of national accord, which is backed by, the UN and most of Europe. And then there is a rival faction who are broadly the heirs to the late and unlamented Colonel Gaddafi. And they're led by General Haftar, and they're backed by an axis of, that includes Russia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and occasionally France. And they had been, General Haftar's faction had been getting very, very close to the capital of Libya, Tripoli, and had been doing very well. And then Turkey decided to take sides. They decided to do a bit of geographical aggressive expansion and have sent a lot of weapons, a lot of advisors, a lot of quite advanced systems, and boy, it's working. The most interesting thing is that Haftar's been pushed back. There are Turkish frigates offshore of Libya providing some sort of air defense umbrella, and Turkish UAVs, which started off by having a reputation for crashing, but I thought that's what UAVs did, but have started to be incredibly effective. And they've been facing up against the Russian-supplied Pantsir short-range air defense system. Pantsir, if you've seen it, it's a massive 8x8 truck. It's got six short-range infrared-guided missiles on the sides and a 30mm cannon. I think up to a couple of months ago, people would have said it was the short-range air defense system of choice globally. Very, very impressive combination of missiles and guns. But boy, in the wrong hands or in untrained hands, the Turkish UAVs have been, I think at the last count, they had six destroyed last week alone. It's very, very interesting because it really does show that however good the system is, if the training isn't good enough, if the operation isn't good enough, if the support isn't good enough, these things are junk.
Everybody, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a great holiday weekend. Sash, I hope you can grab that sunset of yours. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Vargo.
Thanks very much, Vargo.
Yeah, thanks, Vargo.
And thanks to all of you for joining us this week. Please follow our daily interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report. Like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. And check us out on LinkedIn. Check out our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight, bellflight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship. And on this Memorial Day, I hope everybody takes an opportunity to think and to commemorate all those who gave their lives in the service of their country. Thanks again, and we'll see you again tomorrow.